Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. And I'm Michelle Masurgeon, broadcasting from my home.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith, lucky enough to be in the Hudson Mohawk Magazine studio. Tonight we start off with environmental justice issues and Assemblymember John McDonald.
Then we hear from Kathy High of Femme Meeting, an international network of women artists who combine art, science, and technology.
Up next, we look up to the sky in this second installment to the Young Researchers series. First, Theo sells us on green fireworks, and then Lucas discusses artificial clouds.
Rent relief and the statewide ban on evictions are pending New York State bills. Discuss with Rebecca Girard of Citizen Action, the statewide housing organizer.
And environmental justice advocate Aaron Mayer speaks with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce about COVID-19 in the context of climate change. But first, our headlines.
The deadline to register to vote in New York's June 23, 2020 federal and local primary elections is Friday, May 29th. This only applies to new voters. It is too late for existing voters to switch party affiliations to vote in the primary.
After more than 140 years, General Electric has decided to get out of the lighting business. It has sold the lighting division to a firm in Massachusetts. GE founder Thomas Edison first patented a light bulb with a carbon filament in 1879. GE made a breakthrough on what is now the standard design for a light bulb in 1909.
Rensselaer County will hold a food collection effort this Saturday at Hudson Valley Community College. The food drive will collect non-perishable food items and comfort and hygiene items. The items will be used to supply food pantries in the county.
The Associated Press reported that Larry Kramer, the playwright whose angry voice and pen raised theatergoers' consciousness about AIDS and roused thousands to militant protests in the early years of the epidemic, has died at the age of 84.
The New York State legislature has voted to extend the deadline for another year for residents who were sexually abused as children to file legal claims, citing the upheaval caused by the coronavirus.
Nearly 200,000 more New Yorkers filed new unemployment claims in the week ending May 23rd. That increase is 31,769 less than last week's increase in claims. This is in addition to the 2.4 million New Yorkers who already filed for benefits statewide since the pandemic began.
The coronavirus pandemic has lowered the demand on the state's electricity grid by between 8 and 10%, the New York Independent System Operator announced Thursday. The grid is expected to have adequate capacity for baseline peak weather conditions, but a slight projected deficit of 193 megawatts in case of an extreme weather event like a heat wave. In that case, NYISO is confident that it could call upon its emergency operating procedures, said Wes Yeomans, NYISO's vice president of operations.
Grocery store workers will be able to get free antibody testing Thursday through Saturday at a walk-in site at the University of Albany. Walk-ins will take place from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. and people can use the West Avenue entrance.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/Media Sanctuary.
The Norlite incinerator's apparent contamination of soil, air, and water with PFAS chemicals in Cohoes and beyond continues to demand attention even in a time of pandemic. Correspondent Dave Pubble spoke with Assemblyman John McDonald about recent developments and how to address this area emergency.
So I was able to attend your online environmental town hall last week. Since then, a lot of things, new things have come out, but I'm wondering what new things may have come out from your perspective.
So since last week's environmental town hall, DEC has reached out. They are very much aware of the pressing concern. They also realize that right now legislation is not moving only because of the fact that we're only dealing with COVID-19 legislation. As I mentioned in the town hall, the legislation is ready to move. The chairs have signed off. The reality is, even if it went today, the governor has until the end of the year to address that legislation. So DEC in the interim is recognizing that more needs to be done. They are looking at their administrative regulations, as Senator Breslin and I had requested in a letter 3 weeks ago, and that's the latest I have to offer at this time, but I'm hoping to hear from them in the next week or so. So there's a constant dialogue going on between the agency and the members on this important topic. The good news is, at least from my perspective, that needs to be very much stated, is that Norlite was burning this substance, and they have been told to stand down from EPA, DEC, the state, and the city of Cohoes, and they are obliging, which is important to recognize. I think there's a shock value with the whole topic. It's true. We do not truly know what the potential adverse impacts would be. This is why there needs to be more study in regards to, one, the ability for it to actually be incinerated safely and preferably being done in a different area, but two, what are the impacts at this stage of the game for what was burned in 2018 and 2019.
So let's go into a little bit of detail on that one for a second. Since last week, a Wall Street Journal article came out, and that detailed that since 2018, 2 million pounds of material containing PFAS chemicals from 25 states and more than 60 military sites has been incinerated at Norlite. That seems like an enormous quantity to me.
Yeah, I can't attest to whether that number is valid or not. I don't know what the sources were in that article. Irregardless, yes, if it's that number or one-tenth of that number, it's a significant amount of waste. Now, what the percentage of AFFF was in that, because remember, a lot of this is diluted in some kind of liquid, we do not know. But the fact of life is, it was incinerated. We are curious on how successful they were in total incineration, because we're not confident at this stage, either as DEC or either as EPA, on if they would have fully incinerated it, or was there some residue that literally spilled out into the air.
So that seems to be a turnabout from the DEC's perspective. When the press conference occurred with Dr. Bond and Judith Inc., the DEC, within 24 hours, had essentially rejected their findings and indicated they weren't planning to proceed with any testing. Have they now changed their position on this?
In the correspondence I've received on this, DEC has rejected some of Bennington's procedures and some of their assumptions. At the same token, DEC has committed, I don't know if they've done it public, I know I've heard it, that they are doing testing in and around the community of Cohoes. You know, obviously the average person, right, and you're over in Rensselaer County, associates PFOAs with Hoosic Falls. And in that situation, individuals drank those PFOAs for an extended period of time, and there were measurable impacts in their systems. The waterway, the salt kill that goes by Norlite, is not a water drinking source supply. I know the water supply in Cohoes better than anybody else. I was mayor for 13 years. It comes in from the Mohawk River, further up the river, and it goes up to the reservoir where it is run through the filtration plant and distributed back down. So the amounts of measured materials in the salt kill, although important for other reasons, because it may be being disposed of into the Hudson River, which we do not pull our water from, but maybe downstream, that may be important for somebody else down the way, but for the residents in Saratoga Sites, it's not as if whenever they've opened up the faucet, they've been drinking a glass of PFOAs. And my understanding is DEC is doing a significant amount of testing on the drinking water supply in the city of Cohoes to validate that, but that has not come back yet, and we anxiously await those results. So I think DEC is going about looking at, okay, what is the main concern? The main concern is human health. Mm-hmm. And therefore, and I'm not knocking or debunking the Bennington study, but the reality is, it's true. There is going to be PFOA contamination in soil in Loudonville and Colony and Cohoes, and that's important to know. And, you know, it was a widely used substance. But at the same token, let's be very, and I'm just not trying to debunk, I'm just trying to be very factual. Individuals are not drinking that water from the salt kiln. That's not their source of drinking water. Their drinking water comes from a whole other system. Let's make sure of that first. Now, the whole airborne discussion is a whole other discussion, which obviously is going to require more further review, and that's why I'm supporting Mayor Keeler and the City of Cohoes' request with the advocates to have the ATSDR come in and do a health study on impacts on the residents. I did this type of study back in 2005 or 6. I can't remember what year now, because I'm getting kind of up there in years, but it's, I think it was 2005. Yes, 2005, when there was concerns back then about a different issue at the Norlite facility. And ATSDR came in, did an objective. They're not a state agency, they're a federal agency, so therefore they're one step removed from the agencies here in the state of New York, and they did an objective review of the concerns the residents had, and fortunately, the study came back and said that there were no negative adverse impacts on human health, which is important. Mm-hmm. Let's hope that we have the same result here.
So I've spoken with a number of people who live at Saratoga Sites, and they're calling for a comprehensive study of air, water, soil, and blood tests for all residents in the area. Do you support that idea?
I am supportive of that. I do think the ATSDR study would be a first good indicator of what that would be. And once again, I think just because sometimes people get a little bit concerned that the state agencies are too chummy with each other, the information is fast and furious. Here we are, yeah. Unlike most other, no, it is, it's fast and furious. I mean, you know, as if you were in on the 108th Assembly Environmental Justice presentation, I spoke about five different areas, of which four of those areas have been ongoing for the last 15, 20, 30 years. The AFFF issue in Cohoes started on Valentine's Day here in the city of Cohoes this past year. And we have done tremendous work working across multiple levels of government to really bring this up to speed, to really understand what's going on. And we're not stopping. We're continuing to press to find out the information. But most importantly, and it bears worth repeating, Norlite is actually cooperating, has been stopped any incineration, and I do not see them doing any incineration for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. We continue to press our legislation to prevent that, but I think that's important to know. There's been so much information, to go back to an earlier point, that, you know, for the average person, including myself, it's a lot to digest, and you want to make sure when it comes to issues like this that we're factual and actual.
So, speaking of which, I wanted to bring up two very recent pieces of information. One is something you may know about already, which is the EPA fine of Norlite that came out near the end of last week for $150,000. I read through the EPA report on that, and it cites Norlite for violations in 2012 to 2014, also 2015, also 2017, and for release of various toxins, many of which they've released in the past, including chromium, arsenic, beryllium, various heavy metals. The EPA was calling for a fine in excess of $300,000, and that was obviously reduced in settlement. Some people I've spoken to regard the reduced amount as a slap on the wrist, so I'd like your reaction to that. The other thing is something one of our reporters turned up. The American Chemical Society apparently did a study of a PFAS production facility and found that chemicals from that facility could be found more than 18 miles downwind. When you apply that to our region with the shifting winds around the Norlite plant, that's a vast area.
Well, I agree, and I agree with that. I've been saying all along, this is not just a Cohoes issue. It's a Colony issue. It's a Waterville issue. It's an Albany issue. It's a Troy issue. It's a Waterford issue. And that's why, you know, fortunately, we've been able to rally the support of the leaders in those communities to support Cohoes' moratorium and to support the legislation that Senator Breslin and I are working to get passed. In regards to the fines, I will say this, you know, being working with the agencies over the years, and I would represent the city when we were being fined, and usually the fine structure is reflective of what the overall, one, intent is to resolve the issue, and number two, the intent structure is to also see what the past track record has been. I can't explain why EPA went with a lesser fine. I do think that they look at overall what was the impact overall of the violation and what was steps are being taken to resolve the issue. Because in my readings of that, it appears that they had done some test burns after the fact where there were no emissions after the fact. So I think the fine, I can't say if it's appropriate or not. The reality is, I think, you know, there is always a sense of the world that they should find everybody to the hilt until it happens to them. And that's one of those things where Norlite has to consistently be monitored. That's why there is an on-site monitor in full time on that site. That's not paid for. That's paid for by the company, but not hired by the company. And they need to have great oversight. Now, the other thing that needs to be kept in mind here, and once again, I fully support banning the incineration in our legislation. At the same token, there are many environmental groups that have approached me to say, we understand what you're saying, but you do understand something. This is all over, and this needs to be disposed of safely and effectively. And I'm saying, I get it. We can't just leave it in our landfills because we're going to have a recreation of what happened in Hoosick Falls at some point down the road. So therefore, we need to find the right solution. What that is, I don't know. Where it's going to be, I don't know at this stage of the game. And this is why the moratorium that the city put in, that the state's looking to put in, is critical in regards to giving time for the science to fully evolve, where the public can be involved in the process. Because just to say, don't do it, and hope the problem's going to go away, is not going to solve the problem. We need to safely dispose of this substance for our society as a whole. There's a large volume, as you attest to, in that Wall Street Journal. That's just a little pebble on the beach of how much is out there. It needs to be disposed of in a safe and environmentally friendly way that's not going to have a negative impact on human health. Okay. What that is and when we will get there, I don't know. But we're going to at least hold them at bay for the time being.
This has been an interview by HMM's Dave Pueblo. He was speaking with Assemblymember John McDonald about the Norlite facility in Cohoes and the issue of AFFF burning in our communities.
Next, Kathy High introduces the Femme Meaning Organization, an international network of women artists who combine art, science, and technology, with Andrea Cunliffe of the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Femme Meeting, it's an organization that's holding an event on the 29th of May.
It's an organization made up of women who work in art and science and technology. It was started by two women in Portugal, Marta de Menes, who's an artist, and Dalila Honorato, who's a scholar, an academic scholar. And both of them decided that they needed to develop a space where women could come together to share their research in art and science, and also to support each other. It's a very much an international organization. We invite people, you know, it's very open to people who want to join. And people who identify as women, and that can be self-identifying in any way that they choose, we are very open to the, and not gender specific about the term, but use are very interested in non-binary people joining as well. So it's an organization that has actually been founded on the principles of sharing and supporting each other, you know, talking about each other's work and research that we're doing, and then also actually developing support networks for each other. And there's a whole variety of things that the organization does with that. There have been two conferences to date, both in Portugal. And the thing that was really interesting was that they took place in, each of them took place in three different cities. And it was over just a few days. So all of the participants loaded up in cars and a bus or two and went from one city to the other to the other. It was like this little caravan. It was beautiful. And the first conference that I was able to go to started in Lisbon and then went to this beautiful small city on the west coast of Portugal called Évora. And then we went to the south to a city, a small city called San Luis, where Marta de Menes oversees an artist residency program called Cultivamos Cultura. And so we had a center there we could work with. There's also a small kind of eco-friendly hotel that their family runs that we used for the conference too. And we inhabited these places for 3 days. And in those 3 days, the first group of women who met were about 70 people, 70 of us. And each person spoke for about 10 minutes, very brief, but very pointed discussions about their own work. And we would have some time for Q&A. And then in the times that we spent socializing together, the meals we had together, the drinks at night, the, you know, swimming in the hotel little pool or taking walks together, that's where we shared our ideas of future collaborations that have developed and, you know, ways that we could continue to kind of develop each other's work and feed off of each other's work. So it's super stimulating group of women ranging in all ages. I just think it's such an important project that Marta de Lila started. So I started working with them from that moment on.
FEM Meeting is women who work with art, science, and technology.
Yes.
How do you coordinate art, science, and technology?
I'll just use myself as an example. I am somebody who have had, you know, a lifetime's worth of training as an artist, both as a sculptor and as a filmmaker. And starting about 20 years ago, I became very interested in medicine and the medical industry. And so even longer than 20 years. And so I started making documentaries and things like this about critiquing the medical institution. I became interested in sort of diving further into how science research is done. I am not a scientist. I am not trained as a scientist, but I started embedding myself in science laboratories with scientists to learn some of their practices and use some of those practices to make my own artwork. And this is really a common theme among many of the women who work in this area of art and science.
But also biology gets involved.
In terms of the biology, for example, there are artists who are working with tissue culturing, so using cells that can be plant or mammalian, so human or animal, and you can grow these cells into forming kind of covering a surface so they can be used sculpturally. So this is a kind of new practice that has come about, but it's not really that new. Artists and scientists have been sort of overlapping and contributing for many, many, many centuries.
You're heading a meeting on the 29th. How are we adapting for this particular meeting?
Thanks for asking. And I'm going to back up a little bit to give you a little history to this particular meeting on Friday. As I mentioned, there were two conferences for FEM Meeting to be held in Portugal that were held in Portugal in 2018-2019. This past spring, in March, there were two other smaller meetings that were being organized to be held March 21st and March 22nd. One of those was in Paris and one of those was in Troy at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And so we were really looking forward to bringing together a group of women to continue this kind of lineage of what FEM Meeting means and represents. As a result of the pandemic that we're all in the midst of, we had to cancel the meeting. When we canceled the meeting, Brandon Miller, who's also a professor at RPI with me and also serves at the Sanctuary as the Arts and Education Director, Coordinator, and I'm the Coordinator of Nature Lab, we were the ones who were organizing the project for FEM Meeting at the Sanctuary. And we decided to open up a call to the people who were supposed to be coming together to ask them if they wanted to contribute videos And these videos would be a kind of reaction to the state that we're all in at this point. So Marta Jimenez was going to be one of our keynote speakers who was going to come here. She had come to Canada and had to cut her trip short because of the pandemic. So all of us got together and decided to kind of invite all of the FEM participants, not just the Troy and Paris ones, to see if they wanted to send in some ideas, some notes, some poetry, something on video that would reflect how they were thinking of this moment. So we asked them, you know, to think about the viral contamination and the state of confinement that we're in. Maybe DIY methods of responding to the virus. We got some very great videos of how to wash your hands. Like, what does it mean to wash your hands as many times a day as we all do now? And what about collecting herbal medicine from the forest near your house? And how about working to develop a compost outside your house while you're homebound now and working with worms? So we have all kinds of responses to the DIY question. Ways to promote health and healing, fighting fear, activating your community support, and then sort of exploring the virus through poetry or through visuals to plant a seed so that we could inspire each other and then look forward to coming together again next year, hopefully.
When is this being displayed? When is this going to be like a Zoom or is this a Skype or how are we going to share this particular meeting?
What's going to happen is that we have put these videos up on the web and there are about 30 of them. They're short. The longest one is about 5 minutes, but typically they're about 2 minutes. So there's a little over an hour's worth of material altogether. And they're super delightful. I really encourage people to look at them.
How do we get to see them?
If you go to the FEM meeting website, if you go to the sanctuary website, mediasanctuary.org, scroll down to the bottom of their front page, you'll see that there's a advertisement for this event on Friday afternoon, this Friday, starting at 4 o'clock. There's a Zoom meeting of all of the participants and more other members of FEM meetings in the past who will be gathering in a Zoom, you know, our little boxes to see each other and to celebrate these videos. We can't really show the videos online because they kind of stutter and everything when people watch them through their own systems. So we've asked people to look at the videos on their own before they come. And then we're going to talk about the history of how this all came together, what these videos mean to us, what we have learned from each other through these videos. And it's an extended chat.
So this is this Friday at 4 o'clock. Can anyone attend?
I think anybody can attend. I think you have to, I know one thing you have to do is go to mediasanctuary.org and register. Because if you don't register, you will not be given the password to attend.
And to see these films, we go to mediasanctuary.org.
Yeah, there'll be a link there. And also, I invite people to also go to the femmeeting.com website. So it's FEMEETING. FEM meeting, and you'll be looking for the FEM meeting 2020 antibodies under FEM meeting web. And this is the acquired immunity grouping of videos that we're talking about.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Kathy High of FEM meeting, the international network of women artists who combine art, science, and technology. The FEM meeting event will take place on Friday, May 29th, with a virtual dialogue, Reflections of COVID, a gathering of member artists discussing their work and videos presented in response to the pandemic. Again, the event will be Friday, May 29th from 4 to 5:30 p.m. To register for it, go to mediasanctuary.org and select events.
For those of you tuning in, I'm Michelle.
And I'm Alexis. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Up next, we look up to the sky in the second installment to the Young Researchers series. First, fifth grader Theo sells us on green fireworks. Then sixth grader Lucas discusses artificial clouds. The Young Researchers Program pairs grade school students with an RPI student mentor who assists them in researching and presenting a topic of their interest through the lens of sustainability.
The title of the program is the EcoEd Young Researcher Program. The program basically teaches kind of a wide array of research methods and research approaches to understand sustainability issues, environmental and social and economic. The young researchers have their own individual project, and the RPI students that are involved are mentors.
Hey everyone, my name is Sue and I am a rising senior at RPI studying aeronautical engineering. I'm very proud to introduce the young researcher I've been working with for the past couple months. He's a fifth grader at West Sand Lake Elementary School who loves reading, hiking, Odyssey of the Mind, and is part of the Continental Math League. He's been working tirelessly on researching this explosive topic and is now a budding entrepreneur ready to take over the firework industry with his eco-friendly alternative. This is Theo Hart.
We've got the perfect solution to your dirty firework problem. Green fireworks. Developed in India when the classic ones were banned, these fireworks fix the pollution problem. When revealing these, the Indian Prime Minister said, "Science has once again come to the rescue of the common man, and millions of jobs have been saved." According to the European Respiratory Society, using classic fireworks releases medical particles and chemicals such as arsenic, manganese, sodium oxalate, aluminum, iron dust powder, potassium perchlorate, strontium nitrate, barium nitrate, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, particulate matter, aluminum, manganese, and cadmium into the air. Do you really want to breathe that in? In India, some celebrations, like Diwali, used to use a lot of traditional fireworks. This was bad for the environment. According to the New York Times, fireworks emissions during Diwali were down 30% due to our new, clean, green fireworks. This isn't just a problem in India, though. According to a 2009 study by Devin Powell, the snow on New Year's Day in Selbach, Austria, had 800 times as much barium compared to the night before. And you don't necessarily have to be at the explosion to experience harm. Research by Guder and Montefort, published in Lung, India, show the chemicals can stay in the air for a few days. Wow, that's scary. Buying our fantastic fireworks is also good for the economy. A fireworks ban is scary for people who sell them because they might lose money. No need to worry about that. Our green fireworks are just as fun without the dangerous side effects. We have a few choices to select from, so buy these up and give us feedback. Scientists and companies will look into creating even more options when they see how much people enjoy the green options we have. Fireworks of the original kind can be really bad and even kill people with asthma. A 17-year-old from Rohtak, India, shared his experience watching a neighbor die of an asthma attack after a bad air quality day. Even if our green fireworks aren't as bright or long-lived, they save lives. Fireworks are an important celebratory tradition that we all love and enjoy. We don't need to ban them to help people. We can just enjoy our new green fireworks. Make sure to come and purchase them now, before they expire. They might expire a little faster than classic fireworks, but what does that matter if they're using them now? They're only just a tiny bit more expensive than old options. But isn't it worth it to save our lungs? I know my grandpa says, "Thank you." And besides, if you keep buying, the price will keep going down. The more you buy, the cheaper they are. And the more you buy, the more options we'll create for you. Some people have suggested laser light shows as a clean replacement for fireworks. We don't like that, right? We're used to fireworks. We love fireworks, and we love the boom that comes with them. Laser light shows can't do that. We still have some traditional fireworks for sale. Although they're banned, another solution could be to limit their use. Maybe you could mostly use green fireworks and toss in an exciting classic one. How bad could it be? The government may offer this, so let them know you'd like your fireworks salesman to be able to offer a few controlled classic options. This will only work if people purchase from registered salesmen instead of buying off the black market. But that's also a problem with banning anything. But remember, our clean, green fireworks actually save lives. Imagine if everyone used these worldwide. Worldwide emissions would go down so much. And if everyone was using green, people couldn't purchase them illegally from other countries. I believe that given the option, people would buy green fireworks, and over time, prices would go down, and people would develop new mixtures to choose from. We all want a better and cleaner world, so buy our product. Please visit our website at heart.fake.corporations.com. We will provide you with the cleanest, most exciting fireworks there are around. And remember, Grandpa thanks you. And no, this is a fake company. If the product is real, this company is not.
Our next young researcher, Lucas, is a sixth grader who is also a jack of all trades. When he's not researching ideas that can change the world, he's either gearing up for a competition with his future city's teammates, doing karate with his friends, playing basketball with his family, or watching The Office. Lucas's interest in clean water began when he researched the relationship between water and transportation in urban areas for a future city competition, which, by the way, he won Rookie of the Year for. In just 6 weeks, Lucas has gathered enough information to make this awesome radio segment on using artificial clouds to combat climate change. So without further ado, let's hear it from the coolest sixth grader ever.
Have you guys ever wondered what the white streaks behind a jet plane is? Well, it's an artificial cloud. An artificial cloud is a cloud induced by human activity. Three conditions are needed to form an artificial cloud. 1. Air must be near saturation of its water vapor. 2. Air must be cool to the dew point temperature. And 3. Air must contain condensation nuclei. In the U.S., aircrafts produce approximately 10 trillion cubic feet of water vapor annually. Even though people know this, they still don't care. Also, for each gallon of jet fuel burned, aircrafts produce a gallon of water, because H2O is one of the two chemical byproducts resulting from the combustion of hydrocarbons. In the world, about 60 billion gallons of jet fuel is used each year, and about 60 billion gallons of water is created in the atmosphere per year. While the average human being consumes about 26,897.5 gallons of water per year, so this amount of water can help about 2,974 people get a year's worth of water. Because of all this, water manufactured in the air, approximately 10 to 20 trillion cubic feet of ice crystal clouds are added to the atmosphere each year. Most of these clouds will be injected in the northern part of the Earth, which is where I live, and I don't like ice raining down on me. Recently, we had a rainstorm, but when my dad looked at it closely, he realized it was ice. Right now, I don't know if it was because of the jet fuel used in the world, but I know it wasn't rain. It is speculated that artificial clouds have a significant positive impact on climate change. In the past, large volcanic eruptions created particle cloud formations, which had the effect of forming a protective sunshield. This reflected a significant portion of the sun's rays back into the space, cooling the Earth. Climate scientists theorize that the use of this same principle with artificial clouds could have the same impact in cooling rising temperatures due to climate change. Studies into how to effectively and consistently create artificial clouds remain incomplete. However, there are two experimental methods to use to create artificial clouds in laboratory conditions. 1. Cloud chamber, sealed environment where charged particles are introduced to supersaturated water vapor. 2. Cloud seeding, attempt to change the amount and type of precipitation. Even though it's thought that artificial clouds block the sun in damp times, creating shade and reflecting some solar radiation back into space, but at night, clouds have blanketing effect that keep warm air trapped. Worker tower. The worker tower is an object that was designed to collect water in areas with low rain percentages. It is made of bamboo frame, supporting a mesh polyester material on the inside. It is a tower that reaches sky high to collect moisture and bring it down by gravity to the people at the bottom of the worker tower. It is an access point where the people can access their water. All the water is stored in a bucket at the bottom where it will be safe and secure until the people have time to come get it. The worker tower regularly collects 50 to 100 liters of drinkable water per day. The Workatar also collects water from rain and harvests fog and dew.
And you just heard Theo and Lucas of RPI's Young Researchers Program. Brandon Costello-Kuhn, a lecturer in science and technology studies at RPI, directs the EcoEd program at RPI and teaches the sustainability class that offers the Young Researchers Program. This piece was produced by Spencer Keeble and Andrea Cunliffe for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Up next, I spoke with Rebecca Gerard, statewide housing organizer for Citizen Action, about two new bills being pushed through the New York State Legislature, which are aimed at helping renters during the COVID-19 crisis. Hello all, this is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, and my guest today is Rebecca Gerard, statewide housing organizer for Citizen Action. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you, Michelle, for having me again.
Okay, so Rebecca, there have been a few bills going through the Senate right now which affect tenants, and the first bill is looking at rent relief for $100 million fund to pay only residential rents for people who have lost their income due to COVID-19 pandemic. What are your concerns about that bill?
Thank you for asking. We have a large amount of concerns about this bill. So the system that it sets up, and this is a new bill that had just come out, and so there were a lot of other options on the table that are not being allowed to be voted on. The system this sets up creates real potential for harm on behalf of tenants while essentially just writing a check to landlords. And so the way it works is that if you apply for this voucher, if you apply for this program, tenants are going to have to go through a really hard to maneuver and exclusionary process in order to even qualify. If they qualify, their income pre-COVID-19 situation will be considered, and they will be expected to pay that amount at their rent burden status that they had paid prior to the pandemic. So if they were rent burdened before and they were paying 40 to 50% of their income in rent, they'll be expected to contribute that same amount. At the same time, that qualification, should they qualify, means that the rest of their rent would be a check issued directly to the landlord. So what do we have? We have landlords getting money from the state when we're constantly being told resources are few, without having to prove that they are having any financial impact whatsoever, while simultaneously keeping the tenant at the rent burden status that they were at pre-pandemic. So that is first and foremost the most deeply concerning part of this. It does not relieve the stress of paying rent for the tenant, and it hands money to the landlord without protecting the tenant in that situation in any way. Because if they can't pay the other portion of that rent, then they're still vulnerable to eviction and all sorts of other retaliatory and predatory behaviors. It also targets the population at 80% AMI. And so when we look at an amount of money such as $100 million and how few people it's going to reach, we believe that it should reach those most impacted first. And this instead is going to reach those with the most resources, not the least.
Okay, so we were kind of talking about that. In Albany County, the AMI would be $64,800 for a family of three. That would be 80% of the AMI. So your annual income would be $64,800 for a family of three. A 30% rent burden would be about $1,600 a month. So is that the top?
Correct. That's the top. And what we know through these formulas is that they will always be directed to the top of the range. So we are going to have people who make $30,000, $40,000, even $50,000, who are the most impacted in our region, or less, right? Or even less. And those people are not going to be eligible for this program, while people who are making more, right? And everybody should get help. But people who are making more are going to be the ones that get help before people that are making less.
So we're looking for, the landlord should have to apply because they should prove that they're losing income. And then I understand that Housing and Community Renewal is going to be setting up and going to then delegate the administration of this program. And they're going to set up, HCR is also going to set up priority preferences. Do you have any concerns about that?
We do, knowing how HCR manages housing programs that are under their scope. They're understaffed and therefore ineffectual. And so we have no reason to believe that this wouldn't roll out in the exact same way.
The other bill that's coming up is a bill to permanently extend the eviction moratorium instead. What are your concerns about that bill?
Yeah, we have a lot of concerns about this bill, especially as it applies to any area outside of New York City. And we want to be really clear, there was another eviction moratorium bill sponsored by Assemblymember Harvey Epstein that could have been put to a vote, and Senate and Assembly leadership are choosing not to let their members vote on that bill. They are not allowing for it to be voted on. And so this bill allows for you to raise the financial impact of COVID-19 in a non-payment eviction case. That's still harmful because it's dragging tenants into court. It's allowing for judicial discretion. And this bill also allows for, if you qualify, while you can't be evicted, your wages can be garnished. But let's take all that off the table for a second, Michelle. This bill doesn't cover any tenant in any area of upstate New York. It does not cover any regulated tenants. And there are 5 million unregulated tenants in this state. And so those tenants can always get a holdover eviction, which is a no-fault eviction. And there is nothing in this bill language that gives them a defense or a protection against a holdover or no-fault eviction. And so the entirety of upstate will actually not be impacted in any way, shape, or form by this bill.
Banning evictions during the pandemic is basically saying your rent's still going to be due, and you have to prove, again, that you can't pay because of COVID-related, but can you use that COVID defense? And you're saying even if you're unregulated, it's not going to help anybody in rural areas.
Because the bill specifically says that defense can be raised in a non-payment eviction proceeding. It specifically qualifies that. And so what we're going to have are landlords who just pursue holdover eviction proceedings instead of non-payment eviction proceedings, knowing that there's no legal mechanism for that defense to be used in that type of action.
Yeah. And then even at the end, you only have 30 days and you have to pay all that back rent. So there's really no, or is there some long-term recovery plan for the renter where you have to pay that 3 months of back rent all at once?
Yeah, that bill doesn't have anything embedded in it for a recovery plan. And the fact that it allows for garnishing of wages and other monetary judgments really just ensures that tenants will not be able to get back on their feet.
So before we wrap up, what about the alternatives that the housing advocates were pushing, like the Housing Access Voucher Program or the Home Stability Support Bills? What's happening with those bills?
Yeah, this has been a really disappointing failure of leadership. I'm just going to be very blunt, because there were a host of bills that could have protected homeless New Yorkers, that could have protected unregulated upstate tenants, that could have provided actual, real, meaningful rent relief. And Assembly Speaker Carl Heastie and Senate Majority Leader Andre Stewart-Cousins chose to not allow any of those bills to be voted on. So they exist, and there could have been a choice for them to be voted on, and they are not allowing their members to make that choice. And so it's been an abject failure of leadership in this moment on doing anything to address the staggering housing crisis we're in.
So what would you like to see done before we wrap up? What would you like to see done?
We absolutely need the Senate and the Assembly to come back to work and put together a package that actually addresses the crisis that homeless New Yorkers are in, that actually addresses the crisis that the most impacted tenants of the state are in. It should ask that landlords prove financial hardship. We stand in strong solidarity with small landlords who are feeling the crunch of this along with their tenants. But we don't believe when there are limited financial resources that millionaire and billionaire private equity real estate should be getting any of those resources in this moment of supposed scarcity.
Thank you, Rebecca, for your time today, and stay safe. This is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Again, you just heard Rebecca Gerard, statewide housing organizer for Citizen Action. She was discussing rent relief and statewide action eviction bills that are pending in the New York State Legislature.
Up next, environmental justice advocate Aaron Mayer speaks with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce about COVID-19 in the context of climate change.
On the phone, we have Aaron Mayer, a pioneering environmental justice advocate and a public health professional. Welcome, Aaron.
I'm an epidemiological spatial analyst. I actually do maps, and I map things like outbreaks and diseases and the things around the state. But let me say this in full disclosure for your listening audience. I am not here representing or speaking on behalf of the health department, and nor am I in my capacity in any shape or form speaking as a public health professional, but as a public advocate on the environment and human health as they interact with one another.
So as a person who's been working in the public health field for decades, what's your take on COVID-19?
You know, it's one of the things that, you know, when we talk about, and not just my public health field, but as an environmental activist and how my professional work informs my activism and vice versa, you know, one of the things is, you know, in the climate space, you know that the world will face more viral risk and threats as a result of climate change. Increased human mobility is, as we see down in Brazil with the burning of the Brazilian rainforest, what folks are not paying attention to is the destruction of wild habitat and then more wild habitat coming in closer contact with human beings. And it's that transmission from that wild habitat to humanity where viruses that are occurring in the forest. I think this, you know, folks never think of forest and wilderness places as actually buffers that protect human health, not only just the environment. So there's a number of benefits between protecting natural wild places, not only from the global climate oxygen producing and carbon consumption and carbon sink benefits, but also how species left adequate distance from humanity, the risk of transmission of new, what they call novel, that's where the novel corona comes from. So for new types of viruses that would be in the wild and distanced away from human beings, that as we start to collapse social distancing between humanity and wild species, through our overconsumption and destruction of the planet, you're going to start to see these viral risk and threats. And we saw that harbinger with the Ebola risk and threat as wild spaces in Africa were encroached upon. We see that also in the case of China. And again, it's not just the geography where it's happening. It's a phenomenon that's happening around the world. I laugh because this is a little bit of a segue because, you know, anything that doesn't identify the U.S., America is really great to play upon foreign origins of things, but they don't want to point out that the real origins, for example, of the Spanish flu was in the United States. We don't call that, you know, the Great American Pandemic because Woodrow Wilson was great in propagandizing and allowing it to be pointed to, you know, Latin America or Spain. But the reality is that the politics of labeling a disease and a viral outbreak gets away from, distracts from the fact that the phenomena that creates these viral outbreaks is really the issue. That's human activity destroying the planet, human activity in creating global warming. and reducing the ability of speed wild species having distances from humanity is putting us all at risk. So it's not just the climate is destabilizing the world, but it's also human activity and destruction of wild habitat that could also be used to reverse climate change is also posing new risks and threats through disease vectors and viral vectors to humanity. So humanity is learning a crash course in ecosystems. And as ecosystems collapse, things are released. And the question is how prepared civil society is in handling these new risks and threats. But that actually begins with not the denial of climate change and not the denial of the fact that we're destroying wild habitat and that it's okay because it's private property, but the owning of the risk and threats. And then as we move away from international institutions like the United Nations and the World Health Organization that have served as means and tools by which nations can get together and set up international standards, norms, and guidance and practices, as we see those destroyed, it is also a destruction of those safety valves that we once had and we once enjoyed, putting us even further at risk. And so the mode that we are in right now for the first time in American history is one that's not using science, one that's not using international relations, one that's not using global cooperation that has allowed us to thrive up until this point. And so we've actually reached a point where our hubris as a species is now putting us all at risk. And it's now when we need those international institutions, norms, and levels of cooperation more than ever to save our species. Is actually our government, the United States of America, our White House, is aiding in the destruction of these institutions, which is just, as a public health professional, as an environmentalist, as an ecologist, all the above, as a human rights and species, activist, you're seeing violations that we just hit or afford did not see, and we're now all at risk and suffering the consequences.
Well, we're pretty much out of time, Aaron, but if you had to say something positive about the situation we're in, what's the way out? Do you see an upside? Do you see an escape hatch for us?
Well, the thing is that, I think that you hearken to the artists, like John Lennon. You had a thing about that song Imagine and then Come Together, the old Beatles tune. We got to come together. The answer is as simple as when we beat back fascism. The world came together. We elevate the best tools, technologies, and science to solve problems. People marching on state capitals with guns thinking that that's going to beat back the novel coronavirus because they want to go out and put themselves at risk is not the solution. We need to trust those institutions and build up those institutions that expand our democracy, levels of cooperation, but also the science to help us target the threats that we know that are real. And we want to do it in an informed way that lifts and elevates our humanity, and not have government broken down as a tool that further divides us from providing these active solutions. So I'm actually hopeful that humanity is really getting a crash course on science, but more importantly, how good governance, if we really prop it up well and invest in it, can actually save us. So I think that we see coming in November some real opportunities where hopefully all of humanity will speak, not just in the United States, but across the globe, and elect institutions and governments that will come together.
Thank you so much, Aaron Mayer.
Again, that was Aaron Mayer, environmental justice advocate with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce, speaking about COVID-19 in the context of the climate crisis.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Michelle.
And I'm Alexis, co-host and engineer. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.